Welcome to the 49th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Dallas, Texas for a State of the Science Summit on non-small cell lung cancer. At the meeting, faculty from Baylor Scott & White Health System highlighted headway made in the treatment landscapes of non-small cell lung cancer according to histology, stage, and treatment intervention, the likes of which now include immunotherapy, targeted therapy, and chemotherapy. First, we spoke with one of the co-chairs of the meeting, Kartik Khanduri, MD, Medical Director of the Chest Cancer Research and Treatment Center, Baylor Charles A. Sammons Cancer Center of Baylor Scott & White Health. Khanduri explained that the ability to target driver mutations among patients with non-small cell lung cancer continues to grow with combination therapies and newer agents. Research is now focusing on exploring sequential treatment for other key targets. In our interview, Khanduri provided insight into the use of emerging agents in patients with targetable driver mutations.
Many people have used or are continuing to talk about using osimertinib. When you talk about drugs like dacometinib or erlotinib, we know that some of these drugs are sort of better or somewhat better than other first generation TKI drugs. But the question is, which patient will we utilize this drug, and then how will we know to predict that the patient would have a possible secondary mutation with T790M which we could use osimertinib later on? So that's one question that we do not know the answer to, and that will always be an issue for right now. So there are many drugs that are now being looked at for NTRK-based treatments. As we have found out recently that we have the ability to try to test for these kinds of fusions, mutations, etc. In NTRK, a small proportion of patients with non-small cell lung cancer will have them, and we have a few drugs which are showing excellent promise, including, of course, the drug that is already approved, which is larotrectinib, and then drugs like entrectinib and stuff that is still yet to come out in through clinical trials, which are showing promise, where a lot of patients continue to be on treatment and have good responses, both inside the brain as well as extracranially. So there's a lot of promising drugs that are coming out. Each sliver of the pie seems to have a certain promising drug that potentially could be looked at. And there are drugs in progress in terms of research where we are looking at new RET inhibitors, which have shown significant benefit in terms of improvement in response rates and a prolongation of activity over a period of many months. There are also similar evaluations going on in c-MET exon 14 skipping mutations, but each part of them, including HER2, there's a couple of drugs that are out there that are looking at exon 20 insertions which have been hard to treat, and all of these particularly fill one niche in that paradigm of treatment for non-small cell lung cancer patients. And if we were to find them and be able to build on them and know what next type of resistance comes up, we can hopefully reproduce a story which will be like the ALK-based stories where we have sequential treatments for multiple drugs which are available to those patients who have ALK fusions.
Subsequently, Eric S. Nadler, MD, a medical oncologist at Baylor University Medical Center and medical director of U.S. Oncology Health Informatics and Internet Technology, shared that chemoimmunotherapy has emerged as the frontline standard of care in patients with squamous non-small cell lung cancer. However, he acknowledged that work still needs to be done by way of determining effective biomarkers and identifying other promising combinations. Listen on as Nadler highlights key data with immunotherapy in the treatment of patients with metastatic squamous disease.
Well, the pivotal data was fewfold. One is that it was a very large multinational study. Over 150 center participants were in that. And you could use either platinum Taxol or platinum nab-paclitaxel, and the majority of patients, actually more than 50%, had nab-paclitaxel, a regimen that is shown to be preferentially a little bit better in the squamous cell histology, and one that is not quite used in 50% of the cases in the United States. So that's, you know, data that echoes what we knew before, and that there's a little bit better survival and response rate in the squamous cell population used with that agent, but it hasn't been done that much in the United States. So that's one thing that was interesting about it. The second thing is obviously the addition of immunotherapy. Now, we had the non-squamous data far before this, and this was FDA approved on on Halloween day of last year. But really what we saw is an improvement in PFS and OS that was demonstrable and measurable. The data was most clearly seen in the patients who are PD-L1 high, and then secondarily in those that are intermediate. In the patients who are PD-L1 low, the survival benefit and hazard ratio is quite pronounced and positive. That being said, the PFS was a little less marked. And we see that time and time again in these studies, whether it be in stage 3 disease or in non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer. But we're seeing differential benefits, whether or not you're PD-L1 greater than 50%, 1 to 49, and less than 1%. But it basically has become the de facto standard of care regimen for squamous frontline lung cancer right now. I think if it hasn't already become more than 50% of the United States marketplace, it will shortly. It's something I actually study. I mentioned I study patterns of care or the health outcomes and utilization patterns of at least U.S. oncology. And we're seeing the uptick very substantial in that. Again, we tend to use more carbo-taxol in the United States and carbo-nab-paclitaxel, but both were allowed in this regimen. The only other thing I'll mention and questions is that the crossover rate was lower than one would anticipate. I mentioned that in the talk tonight. Only about 30% of patients crossed over to have IO, and when you actually looked at intention to treat, only about 40% crossed over and had immunotherapy. And again, given the fact that this trial was accruing during a time where we knew that second-line immunotherapy was a very beneficial therapy, you would question why were the rates not even 50% of patients, who went on to get second-line therapy. You would think they'd at least be 50% and potentially higher, and then you have to question why. So the data with Atezo had a similar trial design, except for the fact that whether you had Taxol or nab-paclitaxel was actually a point of randomization. So it wasn't dealer's choice in this. The other thing is there wasn't a crossover in this population. They were able to get second-line immunotherapy, but there wasn't allowed to be crossover. The data in this trial was the progression-free survival we saw and was significant in all regards. And overall survival was certainly there, just not to the same degree as we saw in the first trial. The hazard ratios were all positive. We see again the PD-L1 non-expressors do not do quite as well. The response rates are lower. The delta between the response rates are lower. So we are seeing this continued signal that PD-L1 under 1%, or basically non-expressors, tend to derive less benefit. Now, this trial was not as did not have quite the same resulting endpoint in either PFS or survival as Keynote did, and therefore this is not a FDA-approved regimen and one that we are not routinely using in our clinical practice in the squamous cell patients at this time. That being said, as it matures and we see more and more data being presented with updates from this, we may feel very differently about it.
When David P. Mason, MD, stopped by to talk, he said although immunotherapy has reinvigorated the once stagnant space of unresectable stage 3 lung cancer, for eligible patients, surgery remains a core aspect of care in this setting. Mason, Chief of Thoracic Surgery and Lung Transplantation of Baylor Scott & White Healthcare System and Chief of Lung Transplantation, Head of the Department of Thoracic Surgery at Baylor University Medical Center, discussed the available treatment approaches for patients with locally advanced disease.
Well, I think over the last few years, we've seen a lot of progress in terms of therapies that have the potential to be applied to stage 3 lung cancer. I don't think a lot has changed over the last few decades, honestly, in the treatment of stage 3 lung cancer, certainly from the surgical perspective or from the medical perspective. But I think there are several therapies that are really on the horizon that have the opportunity to change things for the better. But, you know, going back even to the 90s to how we treated lung cancer that was locally advanced to how we treat it today, right now, not so different. The standard approach, I think, for stage 3 lung cancers is there are really two treatments modalities. One is chemotherapy and radiation, and the other is chemotherapy and radiation with the addition of surgery. You know, it's hard to compare those two therapies because the patients who get selected for each of those often have different overall medical cross-sections. You know, typically the patients who are selected for surgery are those who are more fit, whose disease might be more localized, and who are potentially more motivated to go ahead and have surgery. So, you know, randomized trials comparing the two, the two treatment arms have been few, and probably there's not a huge difference in the overall outcomes, but in selected patients, there does seem to be some survival advantage for patients undergoing surgery. Often the surgeon doesn't even have the opportunity to meet some patients just because medical oncologists or radiation oncologists might have a particular bias, and that patient might never be referred for surgery at all. So I don't know the overall numbers. Probably a third to a half of all patients with lung cancer need some multimodality treatment. They're not in that early stage, that stage 1 that typically proceeds to surgery, or potentially at stage 2 that receives adjuvant therapy, and they're not in that stage 4 category either, but somewhere in between. So there are a lot of patients in that in-between treatment arm that might potentially benefit from, you know, from surgical therapy. You know, what does the discussion go like? Well, first of all, you know, I'd like to get a sense of the patient's overall fitness. I'd like to get a sense of their overall motivation and willingness to go through a therapy that can be challenging on top of the therapies that they're already receiving, the chemo and radiation, which in and of themselves can be challenging. And then their willingness to take some amount of risk in order to have the surgery, with the potential benefit being that their survival might be improved.
In a similar vein, Ronan J. Kelly, MD, MBA, spoke about advances made in the treatment of stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer, as well as ALK-positive disease. Kelly is chief of oncology for the 10 Baylor Scott & White Health Systems North Texas Cancer Centers and director of oncology at the Baylor Charles A. Sammons Cancer Center at Baylor University Medical Center. When he spoke with us, he said that although the PACIFIC trial introduced a new standard of care in the treatment of patients with inoperable stage 3 disease by administering durvalumab post-chemo radiotherapy, investigators are now trying to determine whether the combination of durvalumab plus chemo radiotherapy concurrently is safe and effective. In our interview, Kelly elaborates on these assertions by addressing the paradigm shift in stage 3 unresectable non-small cell lung cancer and delving into the complex field of ALK rearranged disease.
Well, I think the key trial that we've seen in the last 2 years was the PACIFIC trial. This was a trial that really changed the way we treat inoperable stage three lung cancer. For many years, we just had the combination chemo-radiation as the standard of care approach, and we hadn't been able to improve on that. But now with this particular trial, we randomized patients after definitive chemo-radiation to get either the PD-L1 inhibitor durvalumab or placebo. And the trial results were actually very exciting. We saw that there was a tripling in the progression-free survival. And then recently, a few months ago, we saw an overall survival benefit emerging, which I think will continue to get larger and larger as the data, you know, becomes more and more lasting. You know, we often see that in terms of the Kaplan-Meier curves separating, and then as the time goes on, that effect may be more significant. So that trial was really a landmark trial. I think when it was announced at the European Society of Medical Oncology meeting in Madrid, you know, the discussion said that it was really a tsunami result for stage 3 lung cancer, and I think it's been a practice-changing trial. However, it's not the only trial, right? The other companies, that was with durvalumab, which was with AstraZeneca. Other companies are now using their particular PD-1 inhibitors. We've seen some small amount of data on pembrolizumab, which looks effective. We've seen some data on nivolumab. And then we've got a whole host of newer trials, Pacific 5 and 6 and various other trials are looking at various different combinations. Can you actually give a PD-1 inhibitor with chemo radiation up front, and then after they've had that, can you go on consolidation PD-1 inhibitors? So we're waiting to see a lot of that data. So we haven't seen that. So that was in the inoperable stage 3 setting. And now we're moving a lot of these PD-1 inhibitors into the neoadjuvant setting. So we've started to see some trial results showing the impact of single agent PD-1 inhibitors before surgery in the neoadjuvant setting, which looked quite promising. And now we're seeing a whole plethora of trials, you know, combining radiation with PD-1 inhibitors or various combinations in the neoadjuvant setting. So I think we're going to see a lot of that data emerging in the next couple of years. So we now have so many ALK inhibitors approved. For many years, as you know, crizotinib was really the single agent that we had. But that's what we call a first generation ALK inhibitor. We now have a number of second generation ALK inhibitors, of which alectinib, brigatinib, saritinib are in there. And now we have a third generation ALK inhibitor approved by the FDA, lorlatinib. And then we have a lot of other ones emerging. We have ensartinib and we have other ones, repotretinib. So we need to just see how it all plays out. But the thing where ALK is moving is that I think in the first line setting in 2019, alectinib is probably the go-to first line drug of choice, although brigatinib is also now beginning to potentially look like that could enter that space if we see more trial data. Then the question is, what do you give after that? And it certainly looks like if a patient has an ALK mutation as part of their resistance, that lorlatinib can be effective. But if there is other oncogenic driver pathways, we have to try to overcome that. And crizotinib may still have a role in the small percentage of patients. So really the take-home message in the ALK story is that we need to do sequencing. Patients have to have repeat biopsies or liquid biopsies to determine mechanisms of resistance. And then we can decide which of the novel ALK inhibitors should be prescribed according to what the resistance pathway is.
Finally, Claude Denham, MD, a medical oncologist at Baylor Charles A. Sammons Cancer Center, Texas Oncology, explained the rationale for frontline chemoimmunotherapy in stage 4 non-squamous disease. Denham explained that such rationale, now supported by several phase 3 trials, stems from its synergistic activity, stimulatory effects on neoantigens, and tolerable safety profile.
Well, there's been a consistent improvement in progression-free survival, response rate, and overall survival when immunotherapy is given concurrently with chemotherapy. And typically either one of the chemotherapy drugs or one of the chemotherapy drugs in the immunotherapy is continued as maintenance after the platinum drug is given 4 to 6 times. So there's a fairly standard structure to all those trials, and they show that pretty consistently. I'll be showing some data from a meta-analysis that's looking at that, sort of, you know, confirming that it's a pretty reproducible effect. Nothing unexpected in terms of side effects. There's the autoimmune side effects, the PD-1 drugs, which are manageable for most people, and the chemo side effects. They're really just additive, and no unexpected toxicities in those combinations. Now it's become pretty much the standard approach for adenocarcinomas for a couple years now, and then more recently the squamous cell carcinomas and even small cell carcinomas, to give immunotherapy with chemotherapy. The degree of benefit varies a bit depending on the type of cancer and a variety of other things, but it's a pretty consistent benefit. So, you know, lung cancer is a very, very common cancer. The one population, or actually I would say the two populations, where we don't use that routinely, the combination, is in patients who have a high PD-L1, who have a good response rate to pembrolizumab alone, or checkpoint inhibitor alone, and many times they're treated just with that, without chemotherapy initially. The other population will be patients who have a driver mutation, EGFR mutation or an ALK mutation rearrangement, and those patients typically will be treated with a targeted agent initially. I wish we knew the answer as to whether chemotherapy with pembrolizumab was better than pembrolizumab alone in terms of the high PD-L1 population. Right now the survivals are fairly similar, so it's not clear that giving chemotherapy to those patients is better than just giving immunotherapy alone. There's actually data of giving all PD-L1 positive patients immunotherapy instead of chemotherapy. I don't think we're quite there yet, because there definitely is more of a benefit in the high PD-L1 patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 49th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to learn more about the advances made in hematologic malignancies, register for the July 23rd State of the Science Summit in Pasadena, California. We will also be holding a State of the Science Summit on lung cancer in Twin Cities, Minnesota on August 10th. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. And thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.